morning. We'll call to order the Eastern Municipal Water District's Board of Directors meeting, this being August 21, 9 a.m. We'll call this meeting to order. Do we need a roll call? No.
No.
Okay. Agenda item one is for the Pledge of Allegiance. I'm sorry. We'll
Steve, you have to please the Pledge of Allegiance. Flag. To place by flag allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, agenda item one is reserved for public comment. It's you may speak for any up to 3 minutes for anything that under EMWD's jurisdiction that is not on today's agenda. We have one speaker card. That is Mr. John Munch.
You're close.
Okay.
My handwriting is hard to read, so it's John Munson,
okay.
National Parks Conservation Association. And I just wanted to talk for a few minutes about Senate Bill 307 and its implication for the Cadiz water mining project and how the process for 307 will work. As you know, Cadiz proposes to remove 50,000 acre feet a year from the Mojave Desert and the Mojave Trails National Monument. On July 31st, Governor Newsom signed SB 307 into law. It will subject Cadiz to an independent scientific review by the State Lands Commission with support from the Departments of Fish and Wildlife and Water Resources. To move ahead with the project, Cadiz needs the commission to certify that the project will not harm desert natural or cultural resources. Unfortunately for Cadiz, there is ample evidence that it will harm both. One example, in December 2018, the Department of Fish and Wildlife found that Cadiz's EIR to be flawed and inadequate for protecting the desert bighorn sheep, a state-protected species. DFW scientists will be involved in the state's review of Cadiz. The commission has 2 years to decide. We think Cadiz has no chance of passing the state review, which I think is important news. However, in a bizarre attempt to bolster its cause, Cadiz is paying Three Valleys Municipal Water District, which I'm sure you all know of, is in the Pomona, San Dimas, Claremont area, over $1 million to carry out a series of supposedly independent studies on the project's environmental impacts. And, of course, that will no doubt be forwarded to the commission. The lead Three Valleys consultant is a longtime Cadiz advocate, Tony Brown of Aqualogic. He has written an op-ed in support of the project in the Press Enterprise. He has made multiple favorable comments about Cadiz on its website, including the incorrect statement that criticisms of the project's hydrology are scientifically unsupportable. Yet he is being asked to do an impartial study by Three Valleys of the project's hydrology. Mr. Brown is being asked to determine if there are connections between the desert aquifer and a series of important springs. Independent peer-reviewed studies show that there is a connection. Before his research even begins, Mr. Brown has joined Cadiz in dismissing these studies, and he also participated in a Cadiz study as a reviewer on the exact same issue he is being asked by Three Valleys to impartially study. So we think state scientists and the Lands Commission won't be fooled by this. We're sure they won't be. We don't think you will be. We certainly won't. Cadiz and Three Valleys actually asked us to recently to participate in their pro-Cadiz PR effort, and we declined. And I think you can understand that, and thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Melton. Anyone else wishing to address the board this morning on public comment? Seeing none, we'll go to agenda item two, which is recognitions. Alan?
Thank you.
Morning.
Thank you, President Sullivan and members of the board. It is my pleasure to acknowledge the completion of the 19th Youth Ecology Corps program. Youth Ecology Corps program was started back in 2013 with a simple idea: bringing in young adults and providing them with real work experience and teaching them about the many services provided by Eastern Municipal Water District and how they can become employees in the future. Over the past 6 years, 212 young adults have successfully completed the 12-week program, which is about a 91% completion rate. Of those program participants, 24 did such a great job that they were asked to come back for a second cohort, giving them 6 months of work experience. None of those were actually brought back as temporary employees to finish up the projects that they started. And I'm proud to say that we have two full-time employees that were hired on through the Youth Ecology Corps program. Jennifer Riff, who is our records management technician, which she's here today, and also our laboratory analyst too, which is Eric Morales. The program is sponsored by the Riverside County Workforce Development Board and California Family Life Center. I'd like to do a quick introduction of the staff from California Family Life Center that's here today. Lenore De Jesus is a program administrator from CFLC. Program coordinator is Greg Snow. Career navigators, Rafaela Pelosos, Jose Flores, and Jim Gray. So, kind of rushing through this, my apologies. So at this time, CFLC administrators, if you could stand over by the door, and President Sullivan and Paul Jones, if you could come up, we'll go ahead and pass out the certificates. Youth College Board Associates, when I call your name, please come up, accept your certificate, and you'll go ahead and go over and stand with CFLC staff, okay? Just right over here, sir. Thank you. All right, so first up is Victor Casisos. Victor was part of our Development Services, Planning Services Department. Victor, here you go. Congratulations. Next up is Isaac Sladke. Isaac was part of our Engineering Services Department. Good job, and thank you for all of your hard work. Isaac. Andrew Colzar. Andrew was part of our engineering branch. Good job. Congratulations. Alicia Hughes. She was part of our Public Government Affairs Department. You're right. And finally, Kishana Simmons. Great job. I'd also like to do a real quick thank you to CFLC. They did a fantastic job. They helped me on a daily basis with all my questions and concerns, and they do an excellent job on the recruitment process by reaching out to MSJC and all of the high school students. They do a fantastic job. Thank you so much for that. And, of course, all of our supervisors, Adam, thank you. You guys do an amazing job. The mentorship program, the mentorship that they do for these young adults is amazing. So thank you so much.
And I, before we end, I also want to recognize CFLC and also Alan for the outstanding job he does managing this program on a day-to-day basis. I think its success is attributable to the work that he puts in it to a large extent and represents Eastern very well in this. So, Alan, thank you for all your hard work.
Thank you.
Go to the executive reports, Paul. General manager's report.
Morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. My written report is included in your board package. I'll cover a couple of items really briefly here this morning. One, I want to give you a little kind of update on a project that we've been working on for the last couple of years with Metropolitan. This pertains to Paris Valley, what we call the GAP pipeline. This was a project that will complete a 96-inch segment of the Paris Valley Pipeline under I-215 at the Van Buren Interchange. The project was constructed many years ago by MEP, where the pipeline was completed down to the Van Buren Interchange. There was a gap left in it, and then the pipeline was completed further south. So we've been working with MEP to get that completed because it is needed in a fairly near term to serve future demands in the northwest portion of our service area. We gave a presentation to the board on this in 2018. MET also gave a presentation to their board on that. Their projected completion date, or when we needed the project by, was 2021. So we started working with MET early on the project, and originally they were slated to finalize the design in early 2019 and complete the construction in mid-2020. John Bednarski, who is MET's chief engineer, I had a chance to speak with him regarding the status of the project, and they are having some issues with the project right now that are causing them to relook at some of the design elements. Specifically, that because of a high groundwater issue, which we all are very aware of in that area, but also interestingly, because of that jet crash they had in the area, there was firefighting foam and fuel that leaked out of that crash site and went down the drainage channel and have contaminated the site now. So they're dealing with some of these near-term issues. They're relooking at some of the design. I'm a bit concerned about the potential delays, but John assured me that they will be relooking at that and get back to us very soon with kind of a new game plan for how they're going to complete the project. So, again, a little change on that, and we'll be coming back to the board with a report on that item. Under our past and ongoing activities, our bill SB 414 is in the Assembly Appropriations Committee today. Later on today's board agenda, Danielle has an update on all the state legislative activities, so I'll have let her update the board on that. But the bill is up, and we believe it'll be put in the suspense file, and Danielle will talk about what's going to happen kind of from this point forward. An item of interest to the board is that we'll also be bringing back, and Danielle will talk about a little bit of the legislative aspect of it today, is this de-energization of the power grid during threatened wildfires. I think you may have heard about this. It's recently had some media attention, it's interesting that 10 of the 20 most destructive wildfires in the state's history have happened since 2015. So this is an issue that's getting a lot of attention. The fires in 2017 and 2018, which were the largest fires, if you can imagine, destroyed 23,000 structures in the state. And so the litigation has been brought against the electric utilities because of the power lines and energized power lines causing or potentially causing some of the impacts on the fires. And in 2017, the California Public Utilities Commission and CAL FIRE adopted a regulation that established what they call high fire threat districts, which cover 44% of the state. They have elevated risk in various ratings depending on the potential for destruction. And in response to that, SCE, San Diego Gas and Electric, and PG&E have implemented what they call public safety power shutoff programs. And again, that's where they would shut off the power in anticipation of certain weather conditions that may be, or other conditions that may be conducive to fire danger, such as Santa Ana winds. And they're talking about having very little warning on those shutoffs, that they would be long duration. And of course, I think the issue that we have and we're concerned about, as is all the water industries, is a prolonged power outage
and our inability to operate our facilities, particularly to provide water service, and what that really means for us. So this has also received attention in the legislature. There was just a subcommittee hearing in the Senate on gas, electric, and transportation and safety subcommittee. They held hearings on this last week regarding de-energization process and kind of what the power industry's, you know, shutoff policies are, what the criteria is, what the notification, you know, are they notifying water agencies and other agencies sufficiently in advance? How, what is the criteria? How long will they de-energize? And it's obviously received a lot of attention, and the legislature has a great deal of concern about it as well. So more to come on this. We're going to prepare an informational item to our board. We're targeting perhaps the end of September and to go to the committee in early October to the board to really talk about two elements. One, what's going on the legislative and regulatory side on this, and then second, how this would affect EMWD and EMWD's facilities. And so we're hoping to have that done at that point in time. But this is a coming issue that we certainly need to be aware of. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Do you have any questions?
Thank you.
Nothing today. Nick?
Nothing today.
Nothing today. Yeah.
Just want to add, I'd like to back in May, the board approved two contracts to provide chemicals for odor and corrosion control in both of those stations and our sewer pipelines. One of the two contractors or vendors is struggling to meet the contractual requirements. If you recall, we had consulted with Brown and Caldwell to give help them write some technical specifications for the provision of the product and performance. And so one of the two vendors is using a product, which is a calcium nitrate-based product, and they're struggling to get enough chemical into the pipelines such that it's feeding along a long, lengthy sewer from Crossland all the way over to Winchester and other ones from Sun City into the plant at Paris. Because like the force main, the chemical is basically being used up in the pipe, and so when you get to the pipe, the odors are still there. So we're getting significant H2S breakthrough. Tony Hughes and staff have been working with the vendor to try to see how they can modify the dosing, be smarter about how we dose it, and see if we can find some success there. But after a couple months, we're still struggling. So at this point, we're asking Brown and Caldwell to come in and give us a quick brief overview from a technical standpoint, make sure that we think we're on the right track, but as I sit here today, it seems like we're probably going to have to switch vendors back to the other provider. So I just want to give the board, make your praise of that. Possibly might hear about a couple of complaints here and there, and that's certainly not our objective. We're going to do what we can to be proactive in addressing those as we can.
Okay. Thank you. All right. With that, we'll go to agenda item 4, which is the consent calendar. We'll accept a motion in a second for items 4A through 4J.
So moved. Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. We'll go to agenda item 5, which is the action calendar. 5A is approve and authorize a 5-year agreement with ARM Industries Incorporated in a not-to-exceed full-term total of $1,830,000.
Dan Hill is going to present this item. This pertains to janitorial services and a change in contractual award as a result of an issue that came up with the previous contractor. So, Dan, could you please?
That's right. Thank you, Paul. So, as Paul mentioned, this is a recommendation for a revised award to a contractor that was presented to the board back in May of this year. As you may recall, Worms Janitorial Services was recommended as the up to a 5-year term to provide janitorial services to the district as a result of a solicitation. Following the board's authorization to proceed with the project and in the contracting process with Worms, they identified an administrative error in their proposal whereby they didn't take exception to certain insurance requirements that are required by the district. Specifically, that those insurance requirements are referred to as professional employer organization insurance. That is a form of insurance that is specifically omitted from an acceptable form of district coverage. And PEO insurance is effectively a co-employment arrangement whereby an organization will literally co-employ employees of a firm from multiple firms, typically smaller businesses, to gain economies. So the issue comes in that scenario in that determining coverage becomes quite can become an issue. This item was presented to the board back in November of 16 in a closed session. The risk management department shared with the board the concept of PEO insurance as these were starting to occur. We were starting to see these in the district. And subsequently, we retained a consultant in 2017 to evaluate effectively whether or not to allow that form of coverage for the district. That consultant came back with a conclusion, and I'll read just a snip from their findings. There are problems in verifying the appropriate coverage where PEO organizations are co-employers of the firm, creating potential legal loopholes with regard to coverage. So following that consulting effort back in 2017, district solicitations that are released subsequent to that disallowed the use of PEO insurance. The respondents to our solicitation sign an affidavit that they've read and acknowledged acceptable forms of insurance, and that was the omission that Worms had made at that time. They had signed that affidavit agreeing to the terms, but did not catch the fact that PEO form of insurance was not authorized by the district. So following that, the district staff approached the second highest scoring proposal, that's ABM Industries, and ABM is the parent company of GCA Services, who is our current janitorial services provider. When we looked at that proposal, we brought that back up. We identified that the GCA services was approximately $1,015 per month higher in cost than Worms. And again, this is a $1.8 million five-year contract, significant contract for the district. The delta between cost was fairly insignificant, of about $1,015 per month, greater than the original recommendation with Worms. So as I mentioned, ABM is the incumbent service provider. They've been our provider for the past 10 years. And I would like to acknowledge them. They graciously accepted to continue performance on this contract during the resolution of this problem. So under the current agreement we have with ABM, they extended their service. We were actually in the process of de-escalating service at the time this issue arose. And they stepped in. They've covered us since that time through resolution and pending board's approval. We will enter into a recommended five-year term with them. So with that, it's recommended that we revise our award to ABM Industries. Terms are similar, and that fixed pricing will be in effect for the first year of the contract, and any subsequent increases are limited to 3% per year following. The requested amount, the recommended amount of $1.83 million, reflects a contingency for the potential addition of facilities that might occur over the five-year term, as well as added services that we may need to include over that time frame. Are there any questions I can answer on that?
The delta that you described, is that an approximation of what the correct insurance probably costs?
What was described to us by Worms is that it would cost them over $100,000 per year additionally to provide the required insurance.
But versus $12,000 per year on the contract difference.
Exactly.
ABM has the...
They do have the correct insurance, right?
Yeah. And the contract overall difference between Worms and ABM is about 3%.
Yeah.
I would make a motion for approval.
One additional question, maybe to Stephen. Does this leave us in any liability, legal liability with Worms?
Not at all. They effectively have withdrawn.
Okay.
Yes.
We have a motion.
I'll second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Dan.
Agenda item 5B is approve and authorize amendment to standard form of accelerated retrofit program funding agreement.
John Wirtz is going to give this report. We have an update on the program as well as some proposed program changes to accommodate some additional sites. John?
Thank you, Paul. Good morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. We're here to talk about the Recycled Water Accelerated Retrofit Program, or hereby ARP, it's easier for me to say. A little bit of background. Following the state-mandated cutbacks in 2015, UMWD had already done several efforts to meet those requirements, conservation programs, and implementation of the Water Shortage Contingency Plan, but more was needed. Staff put together the ARP as a conservation program to help accelerate recycled water retrofit and potable water offsets on projects that otherwise either would not have moved forward or would have taken too long. ARP consists of three primary elements. Number one is the technical and permitting design support provided by district staff and district consultants. This includes up to final irrigation retrofit drawings for our customers. Number two is all the public right-of-way work completed by our EMWD crews. This is the installation of new recycled water services, upgrade of fire services, and the abandonment of potable water services. And finally is funding directly to our customers up to $5,000 per acre foot to reimburse for the cost of construction of the irrigation retrofit. We also are receiving through Metropolitan's on-site retrofit program, the ORP, $975 per acre foot for these projects. The customer then pays a special ARP rate, which is set at 75% of the potable water rate. And after 8 years, we'll revert to the then in effect recycled water rate. So the customers benefit with virtually no upfront costs, while immediate savings of irrigation water costs, and EMWD has the opportunity to recover their investment within 8 years. So I want to do a quick comparison and kind of highlight how the ARP does as a conservation program. We have a lot of existing conservation programs, including high-efficiency nozzles and washing machines and turf removal. These are valued based on a 10-year term of water savings, and the programs range from anywhere from $100 to $2,000 per acre foot over that 10 years. Of course, that provides a long-term potable water offset, and it helps to support the paradigm shift of conservation as a way of life. ARP is very competitive, $400 to $1,000 per acre foot conservation value based on 10 years of water savings. It also provides a long-term potable water offset, as well as by expanding recycled water use, thereby the acceptance of recycled water use. And it maintains a lot of recreational areas for our community in times of drought. But one of the key things is it maintains a revenue stream through the sale of recycled water. So ARP is really a low-cost conservation program that provides some really good benefits to our community. So in 2015, we kicked off phase one of ARP. The board authorized $2.2 million in August. Our objective was 400 acre feet. We achieved 469 at 24 different sites. These sites were all, in effect, the low-hanging fruit. We had already evaluated these through some previous studies and knew that they'd be pretty easy. Total upfront cost was $1.9 million, which gives a conservation value of about $405 an acre foot. To date, we've recovered $445,000 through Metropolitan's ORP program, and through that ARP special rate, the delta, we've recovered $425,000 through the sale of recycled water. So it's doing very well. Phase two was kicked off because we did so well in phase one. In September of 2017, the goal of 460 acre feet, board authorized $2.5 million for this phase. We wanted to expand it to additional district customers, and we also incorporated the removal of non-functional turf in these projects. At this point, we've completed 11 of these sites. We have two that are currently in construction. We have two that are finalizing their funding agreement right now. We have one very large one that I'll talk about a little bit later that is in final design. And then there are four projects ready to go to construction that I'm here to talk to you about specifically. First, I want to give a couple highlights of projects that we've completed. Back in September of last year, I came to the board for the Brubaker Park, which is a City of Hemet site. It had been operating underneath a wheeling agreement since 1996. The cost was exceeded the $5,000 per acre foot, so the board authorized an increase of $7,500 an acre foot and extension of the rate to 12 years. That site is online and using recycled water. French Valley Elementary School is the first Temecula Valley Unified School District site. And I want to recognize Dean Wetter with Valleywide. The unique thing about this project was, in order to be able to serve recycled water due to the proximity of our pipeline, Valleywide granted an easement to Temecula Unified School District to install an irrigation main line through the Butterfield Park in order to supply the school recycled water. The Landmark Middle School is one of our largest Phase 2 projects. It's in Moreno Valley. It is the first Moreno Valley Unified School District project and included an upgrade of the fire service from a single check to a double check, which EMWD crews completed. Riverside University Health System in Moreno Valley, very unique site. We are doing a retrofit in conjunction with the $450 million public-private partnership expansion of the hospital. So we're incorporated the design of the retrofit with the design of the new irrigation system and combined those together. It also included a fire service upgrade. We worked with the Riverside County to receive OSHPD approval, and that process taught me a lot. Don't want to go through OSHPD approval again. The Sheffield Park is being served off the French Valley Distribution Pipeline Project. This project is another Valleywide site that included the construction and of a restroom facility and a water bottle fill station. So far, we've received $175,000 in MWD ORP funds. But the ARP Phase 2 projects are definitely a little higher in the tree. They're much more complex than Phase 2. Everything from the regulatory compliance issues due to the proximity of our main lines, consolidating multiple irrigation systems into a single point of connection. Incorporating turf removal is very costly. Old irrigation systems, and frankly, the lack of as-built, a lot more district time, staff time, consultant time. So basically, the result is all of the projects that are moving forward are using the max funding allowed by the ARP program. And the remaining projects are really the most complex, and they're going to require some additional assistance. And that's what we're really here to talk about. Three of those sites are with Valleywide. Two in the French Valley area, Shrimp Lane Channel and the Bentham Channel. One is in Holland Road in the city of Menifee. Total water offset is 66 acre feet, so it provides a total ARP budget of $330,000. Valleywide put these projects out to bid, public bid as a single package. Low bid came in at $700,000. The next lowest bid was $1.2. So they need additional financial assistance to move these projects forward, but they are committed to move them forward. Next project is the Sky Canyon Business Park. The Sky Canyon area is in Murrieta. This is really kind of a cleanup of the entire area. There's a lot of irrigation that is recycled that's directly adjacent to potable. The primary active project there is is with Riverside County Economic Development Agency, the CSA 143. That's the orange area on the screen there. We're nearing completion on that. However, there's a small commercial center, the Sky Canyon Business Park, that once the EDA has retrofitted their site, we will have several thousand feet of recycled water irrigation directly adjacent to potable irrigation. So we either have to build a mow curb on a slope the entire way, which is about $22,000, or we can retrofit that site and keep everything recycled. So we worked with the customer. They went out to bid. Got two different proposals. The low bid is $17,000, but because of the low usage, the budget is very low. So they need additional assistance as well. So what we're recommending is to, for these remaining four projects only, to increase the upfront funding from $5,000 an acre foot, or a $500 conservation value per acre foot, up to $10,000 per acre foot upfront, or a $1,000 conservation value. And then extend the term, the ARP special rate term, from 8 years to 14 years. And as you can see, there's still a gap in funding. The customers are having to contribute some additional funding themselves, and they are willing to do that. but it would be remiss if I didn't talk a little bit about how the ARP has been acknowledged. It's been a really great program for the district. It's given us an opportunity to take a proactive and leadership role in advancing projects with our community that would not have been able to move forward had we not taken the lead. In fact, the Water Reuse Association, the National Water Reuse Association, is recognizing EMWD and ARP next month in San Diego at the National Water Reuse Conference. And we're being awarded the 2019 Water Use Water Champion Award. And Director Rickard, those pipes look more purple on the screen.
They do. We're both having better days today.
I want to talk about a couple of other projects. First, the lakes at Hemet West is a phase two project. I have another slide on that I'll talk about briefly. The other projects listed, there are a variety of large schools and parks that are going to be basically low-hanging fruit again, and they're being made low-hanging fruit primarily because of developer projects that are extending pipelines and also the French Valley Distribution Expansion Project Phase 2 that is currently in design. If we wanted to do a Phase 3, there's a growing list.
Sure, we will want to probably do a Phase 3. So. Keep the list growing.
So the Lakes of Hemet West is a project I'm personally very excited about. It is located in the city of Hemet in the Fruitvale Rate Zone. It has 640 residences. It's not really a mobile home park. You don't want to say mobile home park when you walk through there. I found that out the hard way. But they're the second largest park of its type in the state of California. They have a clubhouse, a pool, nine-hole executive golf course built in the 60s. They have 21 acres of irrigation and 7.5 acres of lakes. Everything is on potable water right now. So it's a great project for looking at retrofitting the recycled water. It's very, very complicated. And we've been working with the customer for all throughout phase two on the design. We anticipate within the next couple of months having a final design package, final cost, and we would like to come back to the board at that point and present the project and the cost and any funding requests at that point. But I just wanted to make you aware that this one's coming. So our recommendation is to approve and authorize the general manager or his designee to modify the district standard form of the Accelerated Retrofit Program Funding Agreement with Valleywide Recreational Park District and Elite Community Management for the Shrimp Lane, Benton Channel, Holland Road, and Sky Canyon Business Park Retrofit Projects. And there's no additional appropriation of funds needed. All of these projects will be able to be completed with the original $2.5 million appropriation. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
I do have a question. I'm very supportive, and I appreciate your work on this. Maybe I've asked this before, but the fire system improvements, that is, there's substandard detector checks, bringing double detector checks to protect our domestic supply.
It's for two reasons. Yes, that's one reason. The other reason is because the single checks that are there currently are not testable. And so the health department requires that if you do not have a testable backflow device on the fire system, that you have to perform a cross-connection shutdown test with the fire system included. And so that means a four-hour fire shutdown and fire watch and all that's involved. So by upgrading the fire system, the fire protection device from a single check to a double check, that allows us to not include the fire system in subsequent. But to your point, yes, it is a definite upgrade to the protection of our system because it is testable and we can make sure that it's working.
And it falls under this program.
It does fall under
this program.
Great.
If you can't call it a mobile home park, what do you call it?
Any suggestions?
I just thought you couldn't call it a trailer park.
I wouldn't try that. No.
A pre-manufactured home community.
Well, that's
you like that?
Okay. I'll move the item, and I also want to acknowledge Dean and Valleywide, and it's a great partnership.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Dean, for coming today.
I'll second the item, and also acknowledge Dean for a great partnership.
All right. As we'll all acknowledge, Dean, we have a motion and a second.
Yeah,
it's been a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Agenda item 5C. Actually, agenda item 5C is a large specific plan with multiple owners. I'm going to err on the side of being conservative and remove myself from this particular item.
Okay, with that, we will have a presentation. Good morning.
All right, good morning, members of the board. So this morning, Gordon is actually representing Eastern at a conference, so I will be presenting this water supply assessment for Winchester Hills Specific Plan 293, Areas 109 and 210. This area is in Riverside County, and Areas 109 and 210 represent 328 acres in total of this plan. There's a combination of medium-density residential units, high-density residential units, commercial retail, commercial or open space recreation, and light industrial. And the project is being developed by Triple M Properties. These land use categories are somewhat different than what we estimated in our 2015 urban water management plan. This table on this slide shows what we assumed in the 2015 urban water management plan, being business park light industry, commercial retail, and medium density residential only. The differences between these categories did result in the change in the projected water demand for the project. These two tables on this slide represent, on the top, table 9, the projected demands for the project. The table on the bottom is the comparison to the 2015 Urban Water Management Plan land use demand estimate. As you can see from the total at the bottom of the top table, you follow me there, bottom of the top table, we're at 1,369 acre feet, which is almost double what we had anticipated in the 2015 Urban Water Management Plan based on the land use designations that we assumed at that time. The main difference in that is the high density residential that has been added to the project that is much different from what we assumed during the 2015 Urban Water Management Plan. That being said, this project, even with the higher demand coupled with the, combined with the other planned and proposed projects that we have already assessed, it's still under the demands, the total demands for our service area for the 2015 Urban Water Management Plan. In the 2015 Urban Water Management Plan, for 2020, we had estimated retail, potable, and raw water deliveries at 93,400 acre feet. In 2018, we had a total of 74,300 acre feet, and we're still projecting kind of a similar trend for 2019. So again, well below what we had projected for 2020. So even with this additional about 700 acre feet, we're still within what we had projected for 2020. This could be related to a slower development in a lot of these proposed projects that we've seen come through the docket on compared to our 2015 plans, and also a continued commitment to water use efficiency. So with that being said, we'd like to recommend the approval and authorization of the water supply assessment for the Winchester Hills Specific Plan 293, Areas 109 and 210. Any questions?
No questions. I will first note that President Sullivan has left the dais on this item, and I will look for a motion and a second to approve the item.
I move approval.
Second. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you for a great presentation.
Thank you, and I.
We'll have President Sullivan rejoin us.
Okay, with that, we'll go to agenda item 6, which is information items in the presentations. A is recycled water cost of service and rates. Charles.
Good morning.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here. It's my pleasure to present this item. It's a little bit of a review of our cost of service and our rates related to our recycled water system. And to be able to do this, though, we thought it might be helpful and useful just to do a little overview of what the district has made as investments in plans and studies and policies associated with the recycled water system to set the context of how we got to our cost of service structure and the rates that we've recently adopted. So if you will indulge me, that's my proposed topics for the day. And let's go through those. And if you have questions, I'm happy to go through those as we go along. So first off, a little background about our recycled water program and some of our policies, as well as plans we've developed. This image here is to kind of show there's a lot of elements associated with how we've constructed our rates, and it goes through a systematic approach that the board has developed with staff and reviewing all of our reliable systems and looking at our water and availability. These policies, plans, and studies collectively guide our system investments, our cost allocation, and our rate development. So I'm going to go through each one of these components, and then we can get more specific into our cost of service and our rates. So first and foremost, we had our integrated resources plan goals for recycled water. So the integrated resources plan goal is to expand our local water supplies while reducing reliance on treated MWD water. The local water supply strategies related to recycled water from this plan in 2011 included the expansion of recycled water reuse or potable offset, as well as new recycled water for indirect potable reuse or IPR. And we just want to emphasize that the plan really is to fully utilize recycled water with the board's goal to fully utilize recycled water without discharge. So meaning that we're looking at keeping all of our water within our service area. Recycled water is a key component of that, and we've incorporated that into all of our decisioning since before that time, but definitely as part of our guidance from this IRP plan. Another document or discussion was related to our recycled water strategic plan in 2016. This is part of our capital plan, development of all of our master plans and facility plans. We had a recycled water strategic plan. It has four objectives, which was to maximize the beneficial reuse of recycled water, minimize net cost to ratepayers, maximize the implementation, and support regional groundwater sustainability. And I emphasize that area because it's really an important component when it comes to our cost of service and our rates for recycled water. Maximizing sustainability in terms of groundwater basin management is a key component when it comes to how do we establish rates or look at rates in context of this objective when it comes to certain customer classifications that can have an impact on our groundwater basins and the sustainability. And we'll talk more about that. Another element is our policy principles for recycled water. This has a lot of components to it. The board's had a great discussion on when we developed it, and we've come back to them, talk about different areas. But most recently, when it was adopted in 2016, we laid out six key elements to it. Just want to emphasize three of them as it relates to the cost of service. And those are to maximize beneficial reuse and avoid discharge, to encourage full utilization of supplies while providing revenue stability, and the next one being establish and maintain competitive rates and charges to incentivize pumpers to use recycled water for irrigation in lieu of potable groundwater. So all of these elements continue to thematically come together in setting our course for our discussions on cost of service. Now, also, these themes fall into our triennial strategic plan and our most recent update for the current triennial strat plan. Has elements related to our reliability of our water and recycled water systems, as well as our wastewater. Again, our wastewater component being a critical element in creation of our available recycled water, as well as its effects for groundwater and our reuse and resource recovery. But this last triennial strat plan, we did enhance the language. Just want to emphasize this red box at the end. We emphasize for the highest beneficial and sustainable uses possible for our recycled water. So it's really a focus on making our investments to ensure that we're gaining the best use of these resources, and that's, again, a reiteration of that commitment. So these elements all come together in setting a theme for how we developed our cost of service last time. So we just want to, again, re-highlight these elements of the goal of fully utilizing recycled water without discharge, maximizing groundwater basin sustainability, avoid discharge, having revenue stability, and having competitive rates to incentivize pumpers to reuse or to use recycled water in lieu of potable water. All these elements really helped shape and influence our considerations for our cost of service and development of rates. So I'd like to go through those next and talk a little about how we got where we are today. So in 2017, the board adopted our cost of service methodology as a comprehensive study. And as part of that study, we reviewed our water, wastewater, and recycled water systems. We looked at all of our investments. We looked at all of our available supplies. And we looked at all of our costs in each of those services. And when we reviewed all of those components, we made a lot of improvements to our cost allocations, as well as rate recommendations for the water and wastewater services. But we also did significant changes for our recycled water customers. Some of the ones I wanted to highlight, though, are the wastewater service. The wastewater service itself includes a component to avoid discharge from that system outside of our service area. The recycled system is really the system that allows for that to happen. In order to do that, we charge the wastewater service a avoided cost discharge component, which is $80 per acre foot as of 2017. So in effect, what we're saying is the wastewater service is helping, is going to have a cost which they're attributed to for ensuring that we don't have any discharge out downstream. We're ensuring that the cost associated with what that would have been is charged to the appropriate group, and that that is then credited and accounted for within the recycled system. And I'll show you how that works.
So it's just a reduction in the cost.
It's a reduction in the recycled water cost, and it's going to be borne by the wastewater customers because we've avoided the cost that they would have otherwise paid had we discharged their flow. The other part, so thank you for clarifying that for me. And then recycled service also included the not only the avoided discharge, but we also spent a lot of time talking about the distinctions between demand at different seasons, a winter and a summer discharge, or a winter and summer use, and those demands. And we came back to allocating all of our storage costs related to high demands in the summer. We took those costs for building our storage and running our storage systems and allocate those costs more heavily towards the summer demands because we had to build those storage supplies in the winter time to hold the water when we have it available in the winter and then be able to provide it in the summer when the demands pick up. And that's how we came up with a summer and winter split between our cost allocations, and that's reflected in our rates, particularly for the agricultural customers. So just back to what were some of the construct discussions for our cost of service. Our goals at that time were to be legally defensible within a Proposition 218 perspective, to simplify all of our rate structures for our customers, to be resilient, to provide sufficient revenue under multiple scenarios, and to be equitable, to minimize ratepayer impacts. And we wanted to do that between our different services, particularly in the wastewater to recycled water in this context, in this discussion of recycled water, and then within our class of customers. So that agriculture, obviously, is one of those that got beneficiary for their demands being in the summer versus winter. If they want to purchase our water in the winter, they're provided a lower cost because the storage cost is not burned to them in that winter time. So those are some of the ways in which we try to achieve all of these goals as part of that cost of service. At the time of the cost of service study, we also evaluated our recycled water rates relative to our peers, and we recognized that Eastern does provide a significant discount relative to other agencies, and this discount is passed on to our customers. It's kind of hard to see, but in this graph, you will see that on the far left, that Eastern's current rates at that time were substantially below the median and the average of these other agencies. Their medians are somewhere between $700 to $1,000 per acre foot, and Eastern's was below $200 per acre foot at that time. And the district still continues to have a substantially reduced rate, and we'll go through those rates. But this is just to show that Eastern's rates are low, and as far as the agricultural rates, they are the lowest in Southern California as far as we have seen comparing other agencies. So we, from that cost of service study in 2017, we then applied those principles into our biennial budget.
and looked at those costs as costs escalate. We adjust those and allocate those to our rate paying customers. Going through what we did in June in our budget discussions, we looked at our operating costs for a recycled water system. This graph just shows the history of our operating costs related to recycled water, and it's trended around $6 to $7 million a year in operating costs, and a slight uptick as we continue to expand the system and improve the service and reliability with additional pressure. So we're budgeting over the next 2 years it grows to about $8 million a year. But this graph or chart I wanted to spend a few moments to talk about, because I think this is really where it shows these key elements of the cost of service and the impact to ratepayers. How does it all really work? So this is from our quarterly reports as well as in our budget. We show our annual figures, our total revenues and total operating expenses, and that which is available afterwards to fund our other obligations. The district charges recycled water commodity rates for the demands, but we're also receiving from our wastewater customers $3 million a year in the avoided discharge credit. That transfer for this year is roughly $85 per acre foot. So that's what the wastewater customers are contributing to offset the cost for the recycled water, helping bring down that rate for the recycled water customers. So what we're doing, though, is we're trying to recover our operating costs associated with the system and a portion of our reliability components. But the recycled water rates currently are not recovering all of our capital and other obligations. As you can see in the graph, we're reflecting that after we include our additional capital investments, including the CIP replacement projects of around $1.3 to $1.6 million a year, some other reliability projects, and well as our debt service associated with the facilities, we're planning to draw from our reserves between $1.6 and $1.8 million each year for the next 2 years. So our recycled water system, as much as it's being more reliable than it has been in the past from a financial standpoint, we still aren't fully recovering all of our operating as well as our capital and other obligations under our existing rate structure. This is why we continue as staff to suggest and advise adjustments to the rates systematically over time so that we can get closer to a full recovery of all of these costs. But we want to do that in a prudent manner, do that something that's in a planable fashion, and we're on that trajectory. We've been doing that for the last several years and adjusting our rates accordingly. But for the next 2 years, we still plan on having a shortfall and covering our commitments based on our adopted rates.
Charles, I have a question.
Sure.
On that chart tab right there, you've got pumping and energy. Can you explain? I understand what the energy is. What's the pumping?
Yeah, so we have other
replacement of pumps, or
we have just operation, maintenance, other things that are happening at that facility. So any other charges that happen at the pumping plant would be covered under that.
Jeff, do you want to address that?
It's generally the maintenance staff that doing works at all these sites throughout the year, visiting weekly and the maintenance projects.
Okay.
Yeah. Great.
Any other questions on that chart?
No.
Okay.
Terrific. So our next area then is our recycled water rates for the next 2 years. We've talked about this again in June as we went through our budgets and our recommended rate adjustments. And we also illustrated that in a prior graph that Eastern does provide a very competitive rate when it comes to our recycled water and what it is relative to potable water. It's illustrated in this graph. The dark blue is our potable rate since 2015 going through 2021. As you can see, it's around $1,200 an acre foot, and that's growing to about $1,400 an acre foot over the next couple of years. Relative to that, we have this gray bar, which is our non-agricultural recycled water rates, roughly $400 an acre foot in the past, growing to about $600 an acre foot. And then the purple and green are illustrating our agricultural rates. That is our summer and winter rates. And those rates are substantially below both the potable rates as well as our non-ag rates.
and then it just helps us achieve the balance of those other objectives. So having that offsets the groundwater demands, allows for beneficial reuse and the benefits of the groundwater supply. So what we recommended in June was a 7% increase for the recycled water rates, commodity rates, again, to help get closer to full recovery of our costs for the recycled water system. And our ag and winter rates continue to be adjusted so that there's incentives for customers to continue to use demands in the wintertime. And those rates are comparable, if not below, any cost they would be associated with using groundwater, roughly $90 an acre foot for winter demands. And we're proposing around $150 for this coming year and then $162 for the summer rates for ag, again, being very competitive rates compared to others, as well as very comparable to operating costs associated with just running their own wells for groundwater. So we think this kind of hits that sweet spot in a balance between all of those different objectives. And we also believe that these rates are still very favorable for the non-ag customers, being that they're at the $476 for demand ag in 2021. And non-ag at $595, less than half of the potable rate. So continuing to be an encouraging rate for customers to move off the potable demands and become a recycled customer. So with that, just wanted to summarize all that material. I know that's a lot, but we do feel that we've had a successful program. I think, as John Worth was mentioning earlier, an award-winning system with our approach. And moving more customers from the potable side onto the recycled water system. But having all of these plans, these policies, components in our strategic plan really set the theme for our way to be able to allocate our cost accordingly and ensure that we have a reliable system. It's a comprehensive approach, and we've been able to avoid wastewater discharge, at the same time recover costs associated with that. We've also been able to differentiate our rates between our ag and non-ag customers and give them incentives for winter use. And we've also been able to ensure that the ag rates are below groundwater pumping cost to promote groundwater sustainability. And ultimately, our recycled water rates are lower than peer agencies and provide the lowest agricultural rate in Southern California. So that completes my summary and overview of our recycled water cost of service and rates. And happy to answer any questions.
Do you have any questions with Charles?
Comments?
Charles, I had a great presentation. Thank you very much. Have we factored in yet, and I don't know if we have, but the loss of the non-ag rate at the Inland Energy Center into our equations going forward? Or?
It's a very good question. So we've just had this year as our first period where we've seen that they're unwilling to continue on going in the future, that demand. They have made commitments to pay for it through this fiscal year, prior fiscal year. So we've been fortunate on the financial side that that paying customer is paying for their demand. There's also, though, as Jeff has prepared the under our policy principles, a demand management plan. In that demand, there's a significant amount of demand for our recycled water. We're seeing a significant level of use picked up, particularly in the summertime. I don't think there's going to be any issues with us having customers taking up that demand this year, next year, and years to come.
Yeah, just questions on the rate, because they're paying a non-ag rate, and it sounds like a lot of that demand is going to go into the ag.
Correct. So we're going to have
financial basis.
Yeah, I mean, it'll put a financial strain on us, clearly, but we are going to try to make up with that by marketing that water for additional sales, but there will be a differential in there.
Okay.
Yeah, this first year there will be that drop if the agricultural customers are picking up that differential for the first year or two, and hopefully with moving more customers into the recycled water program as part of the offset, we will be able to move that closer to the what IEC was willing to pay.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. And that's something that John Worth is working on, right?
Correct. Is getting the what I call the municipal irrigators on the system as well, because they do pay a higher rate. And Dean, you can't qualify the parks as ag uses. Sorry.
I can hear you thinking. I can hear you thinking from that row over there.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions of Charles? Charles, thank you,
Charles.
Very, very much.
Appreciate the time.
Okay, with that, we'll go to 6B, which is the EM11 water transmission system update. Yeah, we'll take a break. Okay, we'll do this.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a request of the board. This is a project update on the EM11 transmission facilities. The agenda today is to discuss a little bit about the background of the project, the status of the project today, highlight some of the coordination we've had with MET, and go over the five alignment alternatives that we've developed so far, discuss some of the phasing opportunities with the project, and what the next steps are. So, the EM11 facilities will be a significant expansion to the district's water supply portfolio. The current planning effort is to develop, evaluate, and compare alternatives for 8 to 10 miles of transmission main, 140 CFS new MET connection down the Skinner plant, as well as a 140 CFS pumping plant. The first phase of the project is expected to be online in 2030, and there's definitely an opportunity to phase these facilities in 40 CFS increments, and those will be highlighted a little bit later in the presentation. Where we're at with the current project, we're about 75% complete with this initial planning phase of the project. As I mentioned, we've had substantial coordination with MET. We've developed five alternatives for the project. Our next workshop in September will be having the first look at the preferred alignment for the project. And we're expecting the completion of this project by the end of the year or beginning of 2020. As far as coordination with MET, today both legal teams have completed the review of the easement documents for the San Diego Pipelines 1 and 2. It doesn't look like there should be any issue for transferring easement documents over to Eastern. The available pipelines, the San Diego Pipelines 1 and 2, should be available for use according to MET to date. They also own a parcel to the northwest of Ald and Washington Street. We're expecting that to be available to us to construct the 140 CFS pumping station. MET is also indicated on the Ald Valley Pipeline. That pipeline at build-out is fully utilized. However, in the interim, there may be some capacity in the near term for Eastern to tap into that Ald Valley Pipeline. And we're hoping that MET will finalize all these internal studies as we progress through our project. So that's our expectation. We did have a chance back in April to go out and do a site visit along the San Diego Pipelines 1 and 2 facilities. As you notice, this manhole structure, that's actually the EM11 vault access. It's located just outside the property line at the water treatment plant down at Skinner. On Washington Street, and as you go into the vault, it's actually a much larger structure than it looks like from the surface. That's the actual inside the manhole is the vault structure you can see on the right-hand photo. As we traversed up towards Leon Road, right before you headed cross-country on the San Diego Pipeline 1 and 2, there's a number of access structures out there. This in particular is actually just a graded vault structure. You can look right down into the pipe. Obviously, with the EM11 facility, we would have to insert a steel pipe into this so we could use it in a pressurized manner. And the last photo I just want to show you from our site tour with the MET staff is as you go cross-country, the whole easement width, as well as the center lines of San Diego Pipeline 1 and 2, actually have been staked. So as you're out there, you can see exactly where the easement width is. It's about 100 to 150 width easement along the whole corridor. Very informative. We had access across all the different properties and fences, and MET staff was very helpful and informative, both to the consultant and EMWD staff that was out there. Moving on to the alignment alternatives. So far, five alignment alternatives have been developed. We did maintain the master plan alignment that's shown in the yellow highlighted, basically up along the Washington corridor and continuing on Highway 74. We explored three new alignments. Those are shown the orange along Porroy, the gray along Leon Road, and the Briggs Road corridor, shown in green. The Met alignment is a little bit more confusing to kind of pull off this figure. It actually it starts at Ald and Leon on the gray section, traverses north on Leon Road, then cuts cross country on the purple highlighted area and over to Met's property. The terminus is actually when it starts heading directly north towards Simpson Road over on Met property. The alignments were developed based on evaluation criteria that composed of three items: construction risks, utility conflicts, community impacts, and environmental impacts. They were developed for the core screening evaluation. We're moving that forward into the fine screening evaluation that will determine the preferred alignment. And with that, we're going to incorporate phasing opportunities for this pipeline as well as detailed cost estimates. Staff recognizes that as we move forward with the M11 facilities, they traverse an area that's not very developed, and there will be in the future utility conflicts arising. Here's just one example with the Wicker Village sewer facilities. You'll notice the sewer facilities go east-west. If we chose the Briggs Road alignment, that corridor would be going right through. The M11 pipeline would be basically intersecting the sewer facilities. So staff will be very cognizant in the future to determine, as growth occurs in this area, particularly north of French Valley, how the M11 facilities may conflict with other utilities being developed and constructed in the area. As far as phasing opportunities, there is a number of phasing opportunities, both with a new pipeline construction as well as repurposing the San Diego pipelines 1 and 2 by relining them with a steel pipe. I'm not going to go into detail, but the first opportunity is basically to get the EM11 facilities up to Scott Road. That would be the 40 CFS option. As we move along, there's another option. There's another option to start north of Scott Road. And basically, there's a whole series of options available for this alternative as well. But one of the interesting ones is being able to split flow, continuing going north and also traversing across the Met easements. So again, it provides us a variety of options for phasing in and basically delaying costs of construction as we move north through the system, supplying water. All of these will be integrated into the preferred alignment and the fine screening analysis. Those are specific to the project. Those are the next steps that we're going to look at. September workshop and October workshop will be vetting through what that preferred alignment looks like, as well as phasing opportunities and detailed cost estimates. The project will continue to coordinate with the Met for the foreseeable future. And the future task for the overall program is to initiate environmental documentation, secure easements along our preferred alignment, acquire property for the pump station site, and then proceed into preliminary and final design. Is there any questions?
Just, we've had tremendous cooperation from Metropolitan on this. It's been a really good project from that perspective, and there's an opportunity to save the district a substantial amount of money on the ultimate implementation of this project. And so, I want to extend that recognition to Matt. And also, Laura's done a great job on pulling this together. It's a pretty complex alignment study with a lot of alternatives and a lot of offsets, conflicting utilities, some reutilization of those two Met pipelines. So it's an interesting analysis, and I think our decision process is set up such that we're going to make the best possible and most cost-effective decision, because this is going to be a very significant investment for the district, but very necessary investment.
I just wanted to add to that, our consultant, Black and Beach, has done an outstanding job. We're very happy with their work, and how they've progressed and the information that they've extended out to that. I'm very happy with where the project's at right now and looking forward to their recommendation on the preferred alignment.
And we'll come back and make that presentation to the board.
Okay. Got any more questions of Laura or staff? Okay. With that, let's take a... Thank you, Laura. We'll take a 10-minute break.